Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. I am Robert Louis Abrahamson, and we are coming to you on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge. Our home on the web is momentsunderlamplight.com, where you can find literally scores of podcasts of earlier shows, and where you can get in touch and comment about the shows. But as I announced on the last show, tonight's Evening Under Lamplight will be the final show in the second series of our programmes, a series that began on 25th July 2010, and we've had 47 episodes for this series. But it's time to let go, time to move on. The archives will still be there, of course, and we'll look forward to Series 3 coming along sometime in the future. Keep in touch with me and with Moments Under Lamplight on Facebook, where I'll be sure to announce when short, non-radio podcasts have been posted. I said last time that we'd do a Christmas special for this December show, but you know us. We never do the straightforward conventional thing. The theme this evening, Under Lamplight, connects us to the myth of Christmas, that celebration of the light of men that shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. That is to say, a celebration here in the darkest time of the year of the light still there for us, a light that the darkness cannot comprehend or take over or extinguish. So a kind of double theme. First, the darkness, the long night both outside us and inside us, and then the light, also both outside us and, more importantly, inside us. Or to put it another way, here we sit at evening tide, under whatever lamplight is shining out for us. Let our show this evening, Under Lamplight, be a point of brightness for whatever darkness may be around us. We are, of course, in the time of the solstice, which is traditionally celebrated by bringing light inside, by gathering around the hearth, the focal point of the home in days before electronic screens, or by lighting special candles in a defiance of the darkness, or in a solemn faith that this darkness too shall pass. There is light outside too, in the starlight. Oddly enough, this solstice time does not seem to speak much of the light of the moon. Is the moon more appropriate for other seasons instead? The starlight is an interesting image. Those remote points of light, not really bright enough to illuminate our darkness, but describing patterns in the heavens that people have been interpreting for ages. It's a kind of mental illumination, a source of meaning and direction, too, as we follow whatever star seems to be guiding us. And speaking of mysterious starlight, let's start off with a little quatrain I came across recently from the Scottish Poetry Library, an adaptation of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, turned into Scots by Lorna Irvine. You won't catch all the words, but surely enough to follow the lines and enjoy the flavour of the poem. Skimmer, skimmer, doosie star, it fairlies me, fair what ye are. Heech aboon the world sae bricht, losin' like up in the lift.
Yeah.
That was Twinkle Twinkle Little Star by Steel Iceman, accompanied by some wee innocents. And you may have noticed that one of the singers couldn't help singing instead of Like a Diamond in the Sky, Like a Tea Tray in the Sky, as all of us who know our Lewis Carroll are always tempted to do ourselves. Well, next we have a little daftness from the old philosopher. Some people's response to the darkness in life is just to laugh at the problems. Treat the darkness lightly. It's absurd that life should be so horrible, so why not take that absurdity even further? Just follow the advice of Eddie Lawrence, coming to us as the old philosopher, in a piece we've heard before on Evening Under Lamplight, but need to hear again every so often, just to keep us moving, even just moving in our seats. Hiya, folks. Let's begin.
Hiya, folks. You say you lost your job today. You say it's 4 a.m. and your kids ain't come home from school yet. You say your wife went out for a corned beef sandwich last week and the corned beef sandwich came back, but she didn't. You say your furniture's out all over the sidewalk because you can't pay the rent and you got chapped lips and paper cuts and your feet's all swollen up and blistered from pounding the pavement looking for work. Is that what's troubling you, fella?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with a dignity and stick to it and you show the world, you show the world to get off. You never give up, never give up, never give up. That ship...
Hey there, friend. You say your radiators didn't work all winter, and now that it's summer, they started up again and you can't turn them off? You say your wife sent your lightweight suits to the cleaners, and that means you'll have to wear your itchy tweeds this morning when they say it'll hit 106? And you gotta meet an important businessman in an hour? And your bridge just broke and you pasted it together with bubble gum and you hope it don't fall apart while you're doing some fast talking to this man. And your shoelace just busted and you open a big cut on your cheek trying to even out your sideburns and your daughter's gone out with a convict. And your wife just confessed she gave you last $60 as a deposit on an airplane hangar. Is that what's troubling you, friend?
Lift your head up high and take a walk in this house with that dignity and stick to it that you show the world. You show the world to get off. You'll never give up, never give up, never give up. That ship.
Hey there, cousin. You say you can't pull your car out of the mud and you're in the middle of nowhere and it's pouring rain and you can't get the top back up and your paycheck's all blurred and your foot went right through the gas and your girl's screaming bloody murder, she's scared of the dark and a stroke of lightning splits your motor in half and your suit's shrinking up fast and you start up the windy road on foot and 60 yards of barbed wire hits you right smack in a push. And your boat falls down in the mud and a wild animal comes over and runs away with your shoes. And your car blows up suddenly and your windshield wiper ends up in your mouth and you can't move and the mud's rising up to your nostrils and you're sinking fast and you don't hear your girl screaming anymore. Is that what's on your mind, cousin?
Well, lift your head up high and take a walk in the sun with a dignity and stick to it and you show the world. You show the world to get off. You'll never give up, never give up, never give up. That ship.
And now, this is the old philosopher saying, so long, folks.
There. So much for Sousa marches and pep talks. So much for Panglossian cheerfulness. But how else do we respond to the absurdity? Sometimes, you know, I get the feeling that Evening Under Lamplight is like that track, and I am playing an even more absurd version of the old philosopher, just in a different key. Well, we can talk ourselves out of the darkness, give ourselves a little talking to, such as Ray Davies so often gives himself. In this next song, we get even more absurdity. In the face of life's tragedies, all he can say is that life goes on and on and on. That's supposed to be the light that consoles us. Or is there also a dim light of some consolation in the thought that we don't really matter in the larger scheme of things? There's no use running around looking scared. Life could get you when you're unaware. One day it's going to come, so you'd better accept it. Life will hit you when you least expect it. And one day when you are gone, you know that life will still go on. But no one will care if you've been good, bad, right or wrong. Life will still go on. But the real light, I think, comes from the absurdity of Le Chlemiel's futile attempts to give in to the darkness. He says, "My bank went broke and my well ran dry. It was almost enough to contemplate suicide. I turned on the gas, but I soon realized I hadn't settled my bill, so they cut off my supply." We can laugh at the irony there, even if he can't. Or does the light come just from the assurance that somehow the people are resilient and keep coming back, even if it's just coming back for more? As in these lines that will sound too familiar to my family and friends in New Jersey and New York. "Tornado, cyclone, and hurricane can batter the houses with the thunder and rain. Blizzards can blow, the waves hit the shore, but the people recover and come back for more. Somehow the people fight back, even if the future looks black. Life goes on and on and on." But now perhaps the deepest confirmation of the people's strength comes from the very performance itself, as the Kinks yet again blend their rock music with the communal sing-alongs they knew around the piano in the front room when they grew up. The song ends up to be a kind of thing we'd sing together by the fireside in winter, defying the darkness. Here, listen to what I mean.
My bank went broke and my well ran dry. It was almost enough to contemplate suicide. I turned on the gas, but then I soon realized I hadn't settled my bills, so they cut off my supply. No matter how I try, it seems I'm too young to die. Life goes on.
Yep, it happens every day. Just put on that deadpan, naive voice. Live for the moment, however you can manage it. But this song is not meant to be a philosophical, much less a theological, examination of how to handle the darkness of life. It's just a defiant attempt to light one little candle of cheerfulness, even desperate cheerfulness. And in its way, an act of kindness in our pain. And this focuses us on cheerfulness and kindness, and it's something I want to look at next. First, let's listen to Catherine Grody reading her piece called Small Acts of Kindness, an account of a little candlelight in the dark scramble of New York life.
Small Acts of Kindness. I had an unusual interaction at my corner the other afternoon, and it continues to haunt me as I ponder its many ramifications. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I was in a hurry to make an appointment for parents of kids who were trying to live through the preparations of a bar mitzvah. And I fast walked to the corner, looked to my immediate left, and waved my arm at a coming yellow cab, which stopped in front of me. As I opened the door, I felt a rather distinct jab on my right shoulder, and I saw a woman looking like a version of myself, slightly harassed, middle-aged, creatively attired, to put it nicely, and profoundly irate. Did you not see me standing across the street for a goddamn hour with my goddamn grocery bags like a frigging pack mule frantically waving at every passing cab, she shrieked. Now, on most occasions in this city when I have a hostile encounter, I become chameleon-like in my response. Though I'm poor at expressing rage in any overt way on my own, if some stranger shouts at me or my kinder, I can easily out-scream them back. Maybe because I was on my way for a meeting with a rabbi, maybe because I had actually gotten more than 4 hours sleep the night before, and maybe because a pet peeve is taxi stealers, or maybe because of a combination of all of the above, I did not shout back in kind. Instead, I spoke from my most sincere heart and said, I am so sorry. I didn't look to my right, so I absolutely did not see you. I hate it when people do that to me. Please forgive me, and by all means take the taxi. And I opened the door for her. She looked at me with great chagrin and said, I am so embarrassed. Would you like to share the cab? It turned out that we were both going in the same direction, and I said I would love that. On the ride, we spoke of the crazy expense of taxis and the craziness of taxi drivers and about how you should always wear seat belts, even though it's a drag to dig them out of the back seats. When our short shared ride was over, I gave her half the fare, said thank you, and we wished each other well. I walked into my meeting feeling an unusual lightness of being, though I wasn't quite sure why. At the bar mitzvah meeting, the rabbi ended up trying to discuss a part of Deuteronomy that talked about godlike behavior, and what did that mean to the assembled adolescents and their parents. Much to my son's total chagrin, I raised my hand, not unlike the wave at the taxi, and said, "I just had a godlike experience." And I told the story about the angry woman and the shared taxi, because I realized that I had been the best possible human self I could have been at that moment instead of the worst, and that did make me feel godlike. It wasn't being able to move mountains or part seas or save populations. For me, the stunning aspect of that afternoon was how profound I had felt just being decent to a stranger and making the best of a typically stress-ridden moment. Being able to be my best self in challenging circumstances made me feel godlike, and full of so many possibilities that I became beatific and felt a sureness about the enormous power and possibilities of small acts of kindness to change the world. My family, in particular the bar mitzvah boy, have gotten very tired of hearing this tale. I tell it often because I haven't directly experienced anything like it since. I have lost my temper at rude cashiers in the marketplace, with people on the sidewalk when they have smashed into me and not managed an excuse me, screamed at my dogs and been impatient with my children. But the memory of my best self on a winter day on a New York City corner with a stranger keeps coming back to remind me of how good it feels to simply be good, and inspires me to remember the day I felt godlike and to see if it is possible to experience that feeling more than once in a lifetime.
The Kinks' song Life Goes On was, as we said, a kind of cheerful sing-along, and Catherine Grody gives us an enlightening anecdote. But let's go on to a more sustained treatment of what we are to do in the midst of the darkness, failure, and confusion we face each day. It's here that we move to our reading from Robert Louis Stevenson, and it's appropriate for several reasons that we should look at his essay, A Christmas Sermon. He called it a sermon, I'm pretty sure, partly to annoy his atheist friends, but also, quite seriously, to offer an alternative to the dour, self-righteous moralism he fought against all his life. This essay formed the final installment of a series of essays Stevenson wrote for an American magazine, and it's good that it features here in the final installment of this series of Evening Under Lamplight. You've indulged my Stevenson obsessions this far. Indulge me a little further, and let me give you a bit of background, not just because your host here on Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, not just because I am a little pedantic about these essays of Stevenson's, but also because I hope you will find the story behind the essays interesting in itself. In 1887, Stevenson and his family sailed from England to New York, aiming to find a suitable place to spend the winter where Stevenson would be free from the frequent hemorrhaging that had plagued him even in the south of England. He had been a cult figure in the New York avant-garde for several years, but after the publication of Treasure Island, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Kidnapped, and A Child's Garden of Verses, he was now a celebrity, and he was welcomed in New York by crowds of journalists wanting interviews and fans wanting autographs. Oh yes, and also by publishers who wanted to offer him fantastic sums to produce essays for them. The New York World offered him $10,000 a year to write a weekly column for the newspaper. The prestigious Scribner's magazine offered him $3,500 for a series of 12 monthly essays. In sterling, these prices were £2,000 and £700 a year, a fortune for someone who only a few years before would have been happy to earn even just £250 a year. Stevenson was embarrassed by the $10,000 offer, and certainly he had no wish to tie himself down to a weekly deadline. But he took up the monthly magazine commission. This was September. The first essay would appear in January 1888. Isolated in what was little more than a cabin in upstate New York, Stevenson determined to get a head start and wrote several essays fairly quickly. But as usual, he became diverted by other projects, notably his new novel, The Master of Ballantrae, and by a very bitter quarrel with one of his best friends back in England. And when he left the Adirondacks in April, preparing for a cruise into the South Pacific, he still had the three final essays to write. He secluded himself in a hotel in Manasquan, New Jersey, and when not enjoying the warm spring weather outside, finished his work for Scribner's. Two of the essays are really just a series of what he called random memories. But the final essay, his Christmas sermon, was a much more substantial piece. In fact, it became one of his most popular essays, sometimes reprinted in a little volume by itself, the kind of thing a sentimental auntie would give you for Christmas. But the essay is far from sentimental. I have a feeling that this essay was written in response to all the self-righteous moralizing Stevenson had come across during his stay in America. In fact, the essay refers to a lady who proclaimed a crusade against dolls. And as he puts it, the racy sermon against lust is a feature of the age. Such moralists, he ventures to say, are insincere, fussing about excesses or perversions of natural appetites, rather than on the truly diabolic faults of envy, malice, the mean lie, the mean silence, the calumnious truth, the backbiter, the petty tyrant, the peevish poisoner of family life. These are the real evils, but the moralists show no zeal against these things. So his Christmas sermon addresses these truly diabolic sins, not with a pious tirade against them, but with his eye on the positive alternatives of the need for kindness, gentleness, and cheerfulness, helping others to be happy rather than judging their deficiencies. Not a bad sermon for us here in the dark year's end. Be aware, though, that he's not talking about some kind of sentimental, nicey-nicey, yellow smiley button blandness, but of the difficulties of rising to our better selves, even though we know this rising is doomed to failure most of the time. We are talking, after all, about just a few little candles in the midst of darkness. It's time for a piece of music before we move into the essay itself, and to toughen us for a Christmas sermon, I thought we might do worse than bring in Dr. Hook with Kiss It Away. Well, not really Dr. Hook, since the song features only Dennis LeCourier, singing and playing acoustic guitar. It's a Shel Silverstein song, but not one of his funny songs. And Dennis's pained voice is not, as in Sylvia's mother, mocking the self-pity, but seems genuinely troubled. The kiss in Kiss It Away, the kiss, of course, is the light he's seeking in this darkness.
There's a shadow on the sun, I see it rising. Kiss it away. Kiss it away. And there's a hurt down deep inside that I've been hiding. Kiss it away. Kiss it away. Now the hard times we've been through, oh babe, we never mind them. We just kiss them away. We just kiss them away. And now I'm looking for the good times. I can't find them. Must have kissed them away. Guess we kiss them away. I keep thinking the sun will shine once more. I'm never ready for the sudden rain. Don't tell me I'm wrong. twice I've been told. I'm so wet and cold. Come kiss away my pain. You keep hoping things will change, and I keep trying. One of these days, baby, one of these days. But there's a coldness in the air, like something dying. Kiss it away. Kiss it away. There's a coldness like something dying. Kiss it away. Take it away. Away. I got a feeling, just like I'm dying. Kiss it away. Kiss it away. Baby, baby, baby. There's a coldness in the air, like something dying. Kiss it away. Away, 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 away. There's a coldness, coldness, and a feeling, feeling like I'm dying, dying, dying. Kiss it away, please. Kiss it away, away. I got a feeling that there's something dying.
Dennis LaCoria, Kiss It Away. Perhaps a little too melodramatic there at the end, but the sudden conclusion keeps the edge on the song. And that's good, since Stevenson's Christmas sermon begins with a recognition of our dissatisfaction with our lives. Here, towards the end of December, as we look back on the past year, all the things we have done wrong seem to rise up and accuse us. But with a little humility, we can be more compassionate towards ourselves and then towards others. It is not only our enemies, those desperate characters. It is we ourselves who do not know what we do. Then springs the glimmering hope that perhaps we do better than we think. That to scramble through this random business with hands reasonably clean, to have played the part of a man or woman with some reasonable fullness, to have often resisted the diabolic, and at the end to be still resisting it, is for the poor human soldier to have done right well. To ask to see some fruit of our endeavour is but a transcendental way of serving for reward, and what we take to be contempt of self is only greed of hire. This greed of hire is doing things for a reward, which means we do things ultimately for selfish reasons and not because it is right to do them. We cannot judge the quality of our good deeds by how much we are rewarded for them, for that reward is never guaranteed. We simply do what is loving and right for its own sake. We pay too much attention, Stevenson goes on to say, to sin, to the guilt from doing something wrong. But we are not damned for doing wrong, he says, but for not doing right. To make our ideas of morality center on forbidden acts is to defile the imagination and to introduce into our judgments of our fellow men a secret element of gusto. If a thing is wrong for us, we should not dwell upon the thought of it, or we shall soon dwell upon it with inverted pleasure. If we cannot drive it from our minds, one thing of two, either Our creed is in the wrong, and we must more indulgently remodel it. Or else, if our morality be in the right, we are criminal lunatics and should place our persons in restraint. When we look at all the things that we have not done right, though, we can become even more dissatisfied. We all want meaningful, heroic lives, full of happiness and doing good, but see our lives as anything but heroic. With a little humility, though, we might be able to see our heroism in small things. We require higher tasks because we do not recognize the height of those we have. Trying to be kind and honest seems an affair too simple and too inconsequential for gentlemen of our heroic mold. We had rather set ourselves to something bold, arduous, and conclusive. We had rather found a schism or suppress a heresy, cut off a hand or mortify an appetite. But the task before us, which is to co-endure with our existence, is rather one of microscopic fineness, and the heroism required is that of patience. To be honest, to be kind, to earn a little and to spend a little less, to make upon the whole a family happier for his presence, to renounce when that shall be necessary and not be embittered, to keep a few friends, but these without capitulation, above all, on the same grim condition to keep friends with himself. Here is a task for all that a man has of fortitude and delicacy. He has an ambitious soul who would ask more. He has a hopeful spirit who should look in such an enterprise to be successful. There is indeed one element in human destiny that not blindness itself can controvert. Whatever else we are intended to do, we are not intended to succeed. Failure is the fate allotted. It is so in every art and study. It is so, above all, in the continent art of living well. Here is a pleasant thought for the year's end or for the end of life. Only self-deception will be satisfied, and there need be no despair for the despairer. And so there is the light in the darkness, though not quite what we'd anticipated. The light shines only when we give up the hope of success in life. How strange that sounds to us today when both technology and self-help gurus tell us we can succeed wherever we really want to apply ourselves. But here is something more humbling, not to say humiliating, at least to our ego. To be honest, to be kind, is that all there is to it? Stevenson won't leave us in this awkward place. There's one more shift of the perspective. But Christmas, he says. But Christmas is not only the mile mark of another year, moving us to thoughts of self-examination. It is the season, from all its associations, whether domestic or religious, suggesting thoughts of joy. A man dissatisfied with his endeavors is a man tempted to sadness, and in the midst of the winter, when his life runs lowest and he is reminded of the empty chairs of his beloved, it is well he should be condemned to this fashion of the smiling face. Gentleness and cheerfulness, these come before all morality. They are the perfect duties. If your morals make you dreary, depend upon it they are wrong. I do not say give them up, for they may be all you have, but conceal them like a vice, lest they should spoil the lives of better and simpler people. In his own life, then, a man is not to expect happiness, only to profit by it gladly when it shall arise. He is on duty here. He knows not how or why, and does not need to know. He knows not for what hire, and must not ask. Somehow or other, though he does not know what goodness is, he must try to be good. Somehow or other, though he cannot tell what will do it, he must try to give happiness to others. was Silent Night, of course, sung by the Cambridge Singers in a John Rutter arrangement, reminding us to look for light in the humble, unexpected places. And sometimes the light we see in the darkness is inaccessible. Dante, waking to himself in the dark woods, the selva oscura, saw the shining sun on the top of the hillside, but he was unable to climb towards the light. Il sol tace, the sun kept silent, nothing coming from that light. No, Dante had first to descend into deeper darkness, into the infernal hell, deep inside the earth, deep inside himself, before he could ascend to the light at the other side of the world. And sometimes in our darkness we just have to wait for the light. This is a fearful position, but if we are still and patient and hopeful, the season will change as the new light grows in the world. This is where we find ourselves in the mythic season of winter, and if you can listen to another meditation from my CD Journey Through the Seasons, let us together, this evening under lamplight, attend to the winter meditation.
Winter. Before spring, we first face that long-expected winter. The leaves have all fallen. The world is dark and cold. All is frozen. No light. No warmth. 'Tis the year's midnight, and it is the day's. The sun is spent, and now his flasks send forth light squibs, no constant rays. The world's whole sap is sunk. The general balm the hydroptic earth hath drunk, whither, as to the bed's feet, life is shrunk, dead and interred. Colors have disappeared. All is merging to deep blue or blackness. The mystery of emptiness, of the unknown. The element is water, the feminine yin world of chaos, darkness, cold, wetness, confusion. The womb where new life waits, not yet born. The waters of pre-birth, touching us on all sides, but never solid, not allowing us to grasp any secure holds. We float as the waters move us, passive, submerged. The organs associated with this season are the kidneys, regulating the water in the body, storing our ancestral energy, holding what we have received from our parents until the time for these gifts to be born in our lives. This is a holding time, a time for storing up and waiting. Our only light is the magical feminine moon, casting uncertain shadows, pulling the waters that surround us here, controlling the tides, sweeping us out to sea, taking us we know not where. The negative emotion is fear. It's too dark to see. We have lost control. Only the fluid water and reflected moonlight, distorting everything. We understand nothing. We can make contact with nothing. No wonder we're afraid. Or a different kind of water. Snow. Colorless and obliterating everything. Threatening to smother all we know. Snow falling and night falling fast, oh fast, in a field I looked into going past. And the ground almost covered smooth in snow, but a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it. It is theirs. All animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent-spirited to count. The loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty spaces between stars where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. If we open to this deep winter energy, fear can become transformed into its positive aspect of stillness, quiet acceptance, and openness. If we move at all, it is with that quiet gentleness we use when making our way across a furnished room in the dark. Sensitive, open, tentatively feeling our way, not rushing confidently through the room as we would in the light. We are listening, alert and still in a silent night, holy night, waiting for what will be revealed, mindful, attentive, not trying to comprehend, motionless in the midst of the emptiness. The night is darkening round me. The wild winds coldly blow. But a tyrant spell has bound me, and I cannot go. The giant trees are bending their bare boughs, weighed with snow. The storm is fast descending, and yet I cannot go. Clouds beyond clouds above me, wastes beyond wastes below, but nothing drear can move me. I will not, cannot go. That immobility, held fast by some tyrant spell, feels like all things conspire against us and keep us from moving on. But we do not give in to the despair. I will not, cannot go. I know it is the time for staying here, waiting in stillness and darkness for what will come next. The long winter night. The long winter night seems endless. When will it be day? No flame in the lamp or charcoal in the fireplace. Lying in bed, listening to the sound of the freezing rain. To an old man, dreams come easy. I let my thoughts drift. The room is empty, and both the sake and the oil are used up. The long winter night. This long night of our dying is necessary preparation. Inside this new love, die. Your way begins on the other side. We hold on, knowing that we do not know what comes next, only that something comes next. All goes onward and outward, and nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. And then the growing anticipation. My heart beats faster and faster, and I cannot sleep. Tomorrow will be the first day of spring.
There was the winter meditation for my CD Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. The meditation featured poems by John Donne, Robert Frost, Emily Bronte, Ryokin, Rumi, and Walt Whitman. The music by Neil Henry. You can learn more about the CD at www.journeythroughtheseasons.com. And now we come to our final song, closing off Series 2 of Evening Under Lamplight with Bob Dylan, who, sitting where it's dark and it's dreary, looks beyond the horizon, behind the sun, where life has only begun. There's that other world, whatever shape it will take, where love waits forever for one and for all. And again, like Dante, beyond the horizon, someone prayed for your soul. Three heavenly ladies prayed for Dante's soul, and who might be there praying for ours? We'll discover when, round about midnight, we'll be on the same side. And so we say good evening and goodbye for now from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, bringing you Evening Under Lamplight, which I hope has shined some light into whatever darkness may have come to your season. Coming to the end of Series 2, I give thanks and appreciation to all my colleagues at Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge. And to you in Radio Land, special thanks always. We'll keep in touch via Facebook. And so, it's late in the season. Never knew, never cared. Whatever the reason, someone's life has been spared. Beyond the horizon, the sky is so blue. I've got more than a lifetime to live loving you.
Beyond the horizon, behind the sun, at the end of the rainbow, life has only begun. In the long hours of twilight, neath the stardust above, beyond the horizon, it is easy to love. I'm touched with desire. What don't I do? Through flame and through fire, I'll build my world around you. Beyond the horizon, in the springtime or fall, waits forever for one and for all. Beyond the horizon, across the divide, round about midnight, we'll be on the same side. Heart is pounding. I felt an angel's kiss. My memories are drowning in mortal bliss. Beyond the horizon, at the end of the game, every step that you take, the horizon. and it's dreary. I've been pleading in vain. I'm wounded and I'm weary. My repentance is plain. Beyond the horizon or the treacherous sea, I still can't believe that you have set aside your love for me. To live loving you.